talk about destruction. Don't you know you can count me in, out, in, out. Be all right. Be all right. Be all right. See, you got a good solution. Well, you know. Well, I'd love to see the flag. You ask for a contribution. Well, you know. Well, do it what you can. What money people mind that hate? I'll tell your brother has to wait. Be all right. Be all right. Be all right. Want to change the Constitution? Well, you know. They don't want to change your head. And ask for the institution? Well, you know. Better free your mind instead. Go kind of pick your chairman mouth. Gonna make it anyhow.
And good morning. Here we are once again. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am your host, Paul Roland, and I have got a guest in the studio with me today, and we will be taking your calls at 503-231-8187. Don't wait too long. That was, of course, Billy Bragg with his rendition of the great song by the Beatles, Revolution. Before I introduce you, remember that? I guess you remember when that first came out, huh, Norman?
I do.
What do you think of that song?
Well, this one's faster. You know, there was a dispute between, I think, Lennon and McCartney over Count Me Out or In. There's two versions. There was the airplay one on a 45, and then Count Me Out or In. They weren't sure about the destruction part. I'm for negating the negation, depending on how you describe destruction. But, you know, let's end the bad stuff and promote the good stuff. That's one way to put it.
All right, well, okay, there you have it, and we can go on to something else. No, Norman Solomon, journalist, media critic, anti-nuclear back in the day. We'll talk a little bit about that. Activist, anti-war activist, U.S. congressional candidate, longtime associate at the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which contributes to KBOO. That's a Fair founder in 1997 of the Institute for Public Accuracy, which provides alternative sources for journalists, including for this show on occasion and other shows on KBOO. Great resource. He was a Bernie Sanders delegate to the 2016 Democratic National Committee, author of many books. Were you on the part of the platform drafting group?
No, I was part of where the Bernie Delegates Network, we were organizing to push overall, like get rid of superdelegates. And you may remember Leon Panetta, the former CIA and so-called defense secretary, was speaking. We were chanting no more war, which actually the Oregon delegation did a lot to help promote too.
Great. And of course, we're here mainly, but not exclusively, talk about Democratic autopsy 1 year later, which is a follow-up report to a year, you and three or four or five co-authors of a report a year ago in October 2017. Well, let me just read this. A team of progressive researchers published Autopsy of the Democratic Party in Crisis, which probed the causes of the disastrous 2016 election defeat. The report came in the wake of the party leadership's failure to do its own autopsy. In a cover story for The Nation, William Grider wrote that the autopsy is, quote, an unemotional dissection of why the Democrats failed so miserably, and it warns that the party must change profoundly or else remain a loser. And then there's some other blurbs from other people about it. Now, Democratic Opsy 1 year later evaluates how well the Democratic Party has done in charting a new course since the autumn of 2017, and it breaks down into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 categories: corporate power in the party, race in the party, young people, voter participation, social movements, war, democracy, and somewhat improved, I guess, is the best that you have. It's mostly mixed developments or somewhat worse, which is kind of discouraging.
It's about organizing, you know, everything good that's happened in the last year. Oh, the last 200, oh, the last 500 years has been from organizing. And that's certainly true about the Democratic Party. You got to do it from the grassroots up.
And you still obviously, I'm not saying put faith, but you see that as a valid place that can possibly bear fruits for actually changing things in the way that they need to be changed.
Yeah, not a lot of faith, some hope, not a lot of charity. We're really seeing that if you organize effectively, you can create some real change. And of course, we know that in a lot of spheres of life. In the case of the Democratic Party, the outrage of the outrageous situation of superdelegates, where these elites were able to put their thumbs on the scales for the 2016 Democratic presidential nomination, or to use another metaphor, when the starting gun went off, Hillary Clinton, before a single vote had been cast in a primary or a caucus, had more than half of the superdelegates, which comprised 15% of the total convention, and Bernie was at the starting line. And so that is a very unfair situation that has been basically abolished. Didn't happen out of the goodness of the heart of the people running the Democratic National Committee. It happened because there's been so much anger that was manifested in people pushing, organizing, pressuring people from Oregon and around the country on the Democratic National Committee. So 2 months ago at the DNC meeting in Chicago, the most recent national full meeting, they basically took it off the table and said for the first ballot, and there hasn't been a second one since 1952, superdelegates don't get a vote to choose the nominee. So we've got a whole new picture coming up, I think, for 2020.
And that is part of the last section, democracy, meaning democracy within the so-called Democratic Party. And I guess that's what leads to the somewhat improved status.
Right. It's an effort to make the Democratic Party worthy of its name, which it hasn't been yet.
And are there particular places in the country that are kind of at the forefront of this, or...
Well, I think it was important that when the votes came down, I would say it was more of a top-bottom battle rather than regional. You know, the great progressive populist Jim Hightower says it's not so much left-right as top-to-bottom or up-and-down, who has the power, who doesn't. And of course, I mean, I always identify with the left, and I think traditionally and in the real time, the left has so many solutions. At the same time, the class battles are so crucial. And in this final decision, just to kind of take a case in point, it was basically a 3-to-1 vote. And who were in the 25%? Well, they were the elite. It was a multiracial battle in both directions. You had people like Donna Brazile, who had been the interim chair of the DNC. And she was saying, oh, you know, we've put in so much time, you're trying to take it away from us. And what she was really saying was, we're part of the elite, we worked hard to be in the elite, and now you're trying to democratize the party. That's not good. But that argument was really overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm. And looks like we got a caller. Sean, hold on just another few minutes while we kind of get the juices flowing here. So the first one, I don't know if that's intentional, was corporate power in the party, which you call somewhat worse. Want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Paul, actually it is intentional. And you're the first person to bring that up who we have done an interview with on this new report, which, by the way, is on the web at democraticautopsy.org. The title of the report is Democratic Autopsy, as you said, 1 year later. And yes, we chose corporate power first because it's really the cornerstone of the problem with the Democratic Party, and the problem really in the United States, I think, is fundamentally the corporate capitalist domination of our entire political economy, and then that flows from there. All the choices we have, the jobs we have and don't have, the social priorities, the spending, and so forth. So we looked at corporate power that is maintained within the Democratic Party, and really that's one of the two sections, categories that have gotten arguably worse in the last year, along with war. And we have a section about the continued fealty and deference to the military-industrial complex coming from the hierarchy of the Democratic Party. It's a mess. And then also corporate power. And of course, those are very interlocked. We give a couple of examples in the report that really spell that out. One is there was an effort to weaken the regulation in Dodd-Frank Act that was successful, and it was a coalition of Republicans and one-third of the senators, 33 House members who were Democrats, to weaken the not overly strong regulation of Wall Street to begin with. And then another example, Nancy Pelosi, the now minority leader in the House, is promoting now this year something called PAYGO, which means that if you're going to increase spending in one area of the federal budget, you've got to decrease it in another. And that's basically a straitjacket. You know, you'd never have a new deal with something like that. So those are examples of corporate power still having a hammerlock over the Democratic Party at the top.
Well, let's go to our first caller since we have one right off the bat. The number again is 503-231-8187. As I always admonish people, don't wait until the last 15 minutes. Maybe those people are just turning in for the last 15 minutes and they think they can get their question or comment in anyway. But Sean is here from the beginning. So what do you got to say?
Hey, good morning, Norman. Good morning, Paul. Paul, you've been far and away the strongest voice on KBOO, making the point that if we have to have consumerism in order to have capitalism, and if we want a planet, we can't have consumerism or capitalism. Now, that's pretty straightforward and pretty obvious. The United Nations just issued the 12-year warning. Thomas Frank, in his book, Listen Liberal, I thought, articulated very clearly. There's like the highly educated professional classes have no interest in abolishing private enterprise. They want to, they're aspirational. They strive to climb the corporate ladder. And these are the people running the Democratic Party. Now, the conversation gets so bogged down. Instead of talking about abolishing capitalism, abolishing imperialism, the conversation gets bogged down in identity politics, gets bogged down in intersectionality. Intersectionality takes the topic of conversation away from abolishing private enterprise and abolishing imperialism. It's the enemy of solidarity. If we don't use universal language in talking about abolishing markets and abolishing imperialism, we alienate millions of people by using identity politics and intersectionality and get away from solidarity. Could you comment on that? Thanks.
Yeah, well, I think of the historic battle cry, if you will, ain't I a woman? I mean, are these really either or? You've got women, transgender people, gay people who are in the working class. They are oppressed in many ways, including their class oppression. And so I think that there's a dialectical series of relationships involved. And so, yeah, you can get extreme about, it's all about racial or gender identity. You can also get extreme, if you will, or at least not take into account what's the whole real world picture that matters. If we say, oh, it's all structurally class, and I'm just like, hey, we're all in this big soup together.
Okay. Thank you, Sean. This is an opportunity. Well, we got a caller, but hold on, Tom, for just a second. So you lived in Portland from 1970 to 1987. I remembered you for being involved with the Alliance newspaper. You wrote there because I was writing there. But I didn't get involved in KBOO until after you left. But you had a show for 10 years, and you were on the board of directors for KBOO. And as I said at the beginning, you were an anti-nuclear activist. You were involved with the Trojan Decommissioning Alliance, if anyone remembers that. It's 1970.
I remember that.
You went to, I guess you came here to go to Reed.
Yeah, and I learned way more at KBOO than I did at Reed College, got to say. Admittedly a low bar, but much more.
And you left Reed before graduating, I
way
guess, because you got so caught up in, you know, 1970. That was still a pretty heady time. The 60s were kind of still.
Oh, we were marching rolling down Fifth in downtown Portland against the war, of course, in front of what was then the Georgia Pacific building. I don't know, maybe it's a big Starbucks now. But yes, of course, the anti-war movement. And at that time, I can't claim that I know the Oregonian is a whole lot better now, but the Oregonian newspaper was incredibly pro-war then, as well as pro-nuclear power. Oh, they vilified anybody who wanted to criticize the Trojan nuclear power plant. And in 1970, of course, as a matter of fact, at KBOO, I interviewed one of the top editors of the Oregonian newspaper at the time that Nixon was renominated for president in late summer, early fall of 1972. And the Oregonian brains were just saying how wonderful the Vietnam War was, just got keep it going.
So, wow, that must have been some of the first, like, public affairs shows on KBOO.
Yes, and it was, of course, a much smaller station, and it goes to the importance of building sustaining institutions. KBOO had just started in the late 60s. It was a very small...
1968 is our 50th anniversary
year. Oh, okay, yeah. And so any reason to support KBOO is a good reason, and so we've got one there, 50 years. At that time, I would say, and we're in a fairly medium-sized room, the entire KBOO studios were maybe 2.5 times this size on Belmont Street around 30th. And KBOO has moved a couple of times since then. But I think the point is that when you build and sustain institutions that rely on people and people power instead of big money power, you can sustain something that is of enduring value. And that means don't take it for granted. Keep supporting it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to our second caller, Tom. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, this Tom. I'm the State Central Committee delegate to the Democratic Party for the Healthcare Caucus.
Uh-huh.
And I do want to give that shout out that the Oregon delegation was quite active both in 2016 and now with the in solidarity with the getting rid of the superdelegates, a very strong force.
Great.
In doing that. And that came about because of some organizing that was done. One of the things that was done background in Oregon for the Democratic Party of Oregon, we replaced all of the administrative and all of the DNC members, the elected DNC members, for the state of Oregon. The work isn't done yet, but we have there's a great platform that people could look at. The top three items are healthcare, energy, and I think corporate personhood, or eliminate money out of politics, or something related to corporations, the top three items. And so we're partially there. If people want to get involved, they should become precinct committee people, because that's the base of the power of organizing within the party, and that's the structure that we've used to replace the people that were holding power inside the Oregon Democratic Party and undemocratizing it at that time.
Well, well put. And I would emphasize it's so valuable to work inside and outside the Democratic Party. We need to be in the halls and the meetings. We need to be out in the streets. We need to be organizing effectively community and movement pressure groups, because the pressure has to be there always from the outside. And your mention of Medicare for All is so crucial, because 8 years ago, the National Democratic Party leadership and Obama, they wouldn't say boo for Medicare for All. It was all corporate tinkering. And now we have actually a majority of the Democratic Party candidates for Congress have endorsed Medicare for All. Almost all of the so-called major contenders for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2020 have signed on for Medicare for All. This didn't happen out of the sky or out of the goodness of anybody's heart. It happened year after year, people demanding that we move towards a single-payer healthcare system. And when you look at what's happened in Oregon statewide, of course, there have been demographic shifts and so forth, but we had just really clunky right-wing senators from the state, Smith, Packwood, et cetera, et cetera. Now we have Merkley, who you can make some critiques. He's been, my main critique would be his signing on to the anti-Russia frenzy, which is very dangerous with all the nuclear weapons pointed in both directions. But other than that, Merkley has generally been very good. Wyden is, you know, no progressive saint, and his economic policies on trade are lousy from my vantage point. But still, that's because people are pushing. And whether it's a city government or state or nationwide, that's how change happens.
Okay, I just add a couple more things. One is, it's very easy to become a precinct committee person mm-hmm. through your county party. You just have to sign up, basically, and mostly you can just get appointed. If you get elected, you are an official elected party, and you basically can't get tossed out once you're elected in. And that's a very important point in terms of people power. And so I ask people to get involved from the inside and the outside, of course. And I love KBOO, and thanks for all you do over there.
Hey, you made a lot of great points. And let me add that there are a couple of pitfalls just to keep in mind. I was on the State Central Committee of the Democratic Party in the state of California for 6 years. And one of the pitfalls is they try to bore you to death. If you go to meetings and just, oh, my God, this is so boring. Well, bring some knitting or bring a crossword puzzle, but stay in the meetings. And the other pitfall is to keep the outside part going, too, so we're inside and outside the party.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling. We got another caller. Hold off on just a second, James. I want to Well, first of all, I'm speaking with Norman Solomon. He's here. And why are you here in town?
That's an existential question. Well, actually, I'm on the way to Salem. Tonight I'm speaking at Willamette University at 7:30. It's an annual peace lecture. I take lecture as a noun. I'm not going to verbally, as a verb, lecture anybody. But it's a peace forum at Willamette U tonight, as I say, 7:30. And then tomorrow night at the Wayne Morse Center at 6:30 at the University of Oregon in Eugene, I will be speaking about media propaganda and war. And for me, it's actually quite moving. You know, I heard Wayne Morse in person once during the Vietnam War, and I've never forgotten it. So for me to be able to speak at the Wayne Morse Center at U of O, I'm glad I can do it.
All right, so you have two opportunities, especially people further south along the Willamette River. Willamette University tonight at 7:30, University of Oregon tomorrow. So keep that in mind. And so your second one is Race and the Party. Mixed developments, and of course that goes really strongly along with voter participation, which we heard on Democracy Now, and she's been focusing a lot specifically with the case of Georgia, a kind of extreme case of Georgia. I guess there's a lot of extreme cases.
Yes.
So talk about race and voter participation in the Democratic Party.
Yes, you've mentioned two of the other sections of this new report, Democratic Autopsy 1 year later. Again, the full thing is at democraticautopsy.org on the web. And we've gotten a very mixed set of developments. I mean, overall, and we have another section related on social movements, the hierarchy of the Democratic Party has faced a real dilemma. A year ago, they literally were putting up barricades when Nina Turner and folks from Our Revolution went to the DNC headquarters, a sort of a fortress in D.C., and it's dawned on those running the National Party that without progressives, they are sunk. The data are there, the polling. At the grassroots, there's a pull to the left because that's where people are at. And so when it comes to voter participation, as we document in the report, the basic progressive platform and program is very popular. You've got overwhelming majorities for free public education in higher education colleges. You've got high support for single-payer Medicare for all, other programs taxing the rich. Once you get away from the news media gobbledygook that distorts these proposals and you just ask people straight out, very high majorities. And so mechanically, the barriers to a progressive majority being elected have to do with voter suppression, as you mentioned, Paul, in terms of Georgia, for instance, outrageous racism, trying to prevent people who would vote Democratic overwhelmingly from actually voting. And this is true in many states controlled by Republican government. So that's one set of problems. And the other problem is that if you don't give people something to vote for that excites them, they're not going to turn out. And that's where voter participation comes in terms of racism. You know, Hillary Clinton was very good at putting Black and Latino and Native American faces on the stage at the Democratic National Convention 2 years ago, but it was sort of bass-ackwards. There was a symbolism, okay, that's fine, but the resources weren't put into voter outreach in terms of people of color communities, so the turnout was significantly lower than 4 years earlier in 2016. And another huge problem is the programs didn't really advance very much. I mean, what did Obama do, the Obama administration do for people of color economically? Very little. He just sort of coasted along on the Wall Street agenda, and we've seen the result of a fall off of participation. Let me add one other thing while we're talking about sections. I mentioned that two of the downsides that we covered had to do with corporate power and war. The most anti-war demographic historically in this country has been people of color. And one of the insidious things, particularly African Americans, one of the very negative effects of the Obama administration was he continued basically perpetual war policies driven by the military-industrial surveillance complex, and he actually deflected a lot of African Americans from a clarity of view because there was the tacit feeling, oh, well, you know, President Obama, first African American president, war can't be so bad after all. He keeps sending in the drone strikes and all the rest of it. So this is a challenge because we really have to tax the rich and cut the military spending.
Okay, well, let's go to our next caller. And at 503-231-8187 is the number, and you too can join in the conversation, ask your question, or make your comment. James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. You know, I really appreciate I apologize. I forgot the guest name already.
Me too.
Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon.
Norman Solomon. Okay, I really appreciate Norman's commentary, especially from somebody who's worked within the Democratic National Convention. And, you know, that first caller, that Sean dude, he's a lot of it. His that sort of jargon about the about, you know, identity politics and race, it's like, you know, flip the coin, dude. Like, look at, like, we've been steeped in white nationalism as a country that isn't even white for, you know, like 600 years, you know, like, and I think that's a lot of the reason why I don't support Democrats on a national level, because we are left out of the conversation. Like Norm was saying, you know, Hillary Clinton was really good about trotting our people across the stage, trotting out black folks, Native Americans, Latinos, but then there's no resources there. You know, so much of my arguments with my liberal friends is that, you know, pardon the expression, but, you know, most of the lip service given to our communities, that's what it is. It's a hand job. You know, it does nothing for us. And, you know, and if you're not willing to look at the historic disenfranchisement, not just from conservatives, but from liberals as well, white liberals in particular, you know, we will not be able to go anywhere. And to tell us to have to ignore our plight in order to support this so-called togetherness, that's just Stockholm syndrome. That's just, you know, loving your abuser. But that's mostly my frustration. When I heard that, it was just like, come on, man, really? But anyway, you know, I really like this focus on because the corporate situation has been out of control for, you know, at least since the Clinton administration, you know, with the passing of NAFTA, the omnibus crime bill, and you know, the removal of Glass-Steagall. And it's in so many ways there hasn't been a way to discern outside of just the traditional feel your pain language peddled by the Democratic Party, but, you know, on platforms, there really hasn't been any difference. So, I mean, I'm definitely, how do we talk to people who, because, I mean, really, people talk about divisiveness in terms of campaign, but, you know, the only divisiveness I really see is people really digging their feet in as either a, you know, as a Republican or a Democrat, or a conservative or a liberal, but they're not willing to look at the fact that, you know, a lot of the same cats, like you were saying, you know, Nancy Pelosi, she might.
Okay, let's give Norman a chance to respond, okay?
Yeah, well okay, thanks sorry. For that. And, you know, I certainly, the Clinton administration pushed what's called a neoliberal policy in terms of trade and, you know, the era of big government's over except for the Pentagon, et cetera, et cetera. You can really go back to the Reagan administration, began the wholesale assault on the public sector environmentally, yeah, and in terms of economic policy and what's called Thatcherism in the UK incarnation. So we've been dealing with this ever since, feeling the repercussions of the reframing and the move rightward. And thanks for that call. And I certainly agree with you. We don't need to go either or here in terms of so-called identity politics or a class analysis. It's all really there. It's all right in front of us. We're right in the middle of us, sometimes hidden in plain sight, these different layers and interactions with each other of layers of oppression and suppression. And we should note explicitly, it's been a little implicit in our conversation here this morning, that we're under an unprecedented right-wing assault, not just from state governments, but dominance of the executive and legislative branches, and increasingly, as a result, the judicial branches of the U.S. government. The Trump administration is a complete disaster for any humanity in virtually any realm we would think of. And that's where, you know, unless we're, and I'm not against hallucinations per se, but politically, I think hallucinations are really bad. And so when we have people, and there are folks, even some people who are brilliant in some ways, who will say there's zero difference between Democrats and Republicans, to me, that's a form of trying to gaslight the left. There's clearly huge differences between this Trump administration around racism, around climate, around many other issues, around who is being put on the Supreme Court, and the last Democrats we've had in the White House. So let's be, as I say, dialectical about it and realize that we have a mission to fight the right, the xenophobes, the racists, the misogynists, who now are so thrilled to have Trump as president, and at the same time realize that we've got to fight for a progressive agenda. And simply to say, to go back to, I mean, I am so sick of getting Barack Obama emails from the DNC. No, I don't want to go back to the Obama administration. We need to, as Bernie Sanders has articulated in terms of domestic policy, fight for a drastic reorientation so it's about people and not Wall Street.
All right. And thank you, James, for calling 503-231-8187. All lines are open, so please get your calls in sooner rather than later. If you're there kind of on the fence wondering if you should call in, just don't wait till the last 10 minutes is my request. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Norman Solomon, who's a co-author I have all their names. Who are some of the other co-authors?
Oh, yes. A number of people. Well, Jeff Cohen, who co-founded RootsAction.org with me and who previously founded FAIR, which does, as you noted, the Counterspin program that's heard, I think, on KBOO. Mm-hmm. Also, Donna Smith, who is a longtime leader of Progressive Democrats of America. Pia Gallegos, who is the chair of the Adelante Progressive Caucus of the New Mexico Democratic Party. And Sam McCann, who is a human rights researcher. Most recently, his project, he worked on the Michael Moore film, Fahrenheit 11/9.
Uh-huh. And they are the authors of both the original report, Autopsy, The Democratic Party in Crisis, written a year ago, and the new report, Autopsy, 1 year later. And that's what we're talking about here on Wednesday Talk Radio. 503-231-8187. This is a fairly rare opportunity to hear Norman back on the airwaves. I think someone said they heard you on KBOO on some other probably nationally syndicated show last week at some point.
Well, I was lucky to be on the KPFA program Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, okay. And we were talking about a lot of these issues.
Right on. Yes, we do tend to cover a lot of the same issues. I've had shared some guests with Dennis Bernstein. Of course, he's got a lot more reach with his show, and has been at it quite a bit longer. Gosh, going back to Iran Contra Gate and well before.
Right.
You're probably about the same generation as Dennis.
We are. I remember being with Dennis in the studio before he went to California. He was at WBI in New York. His, as you mentioned, Iran Contra Gate show, where he broke a lot of new ground. You know, there's always the official media coverage, and then he went underneath in terms of the that point. Gee, Reagan administration complicity with out-and-out fascists in Central America.
And it was, I don't know if it was the first, but it was kind of unique in terms of being a nationally broadcast daily Pacifica program.
That's right. Yeah.
And there's been a couple others since, but of course, we could get into the problems in Pacifica. You want to talk a little bit about the problems in Pacifica?
Oh, well, you know, community radio has always... I think the proper term, we're told to say challenges, not problems, whatever you want to call them. You know, it's uphill. We're in this corporate economic system, and it's hard to keep the money flowing sufficient. And we're trained in certain ways in terms of maybe mitigating against cooperation. But a lot is being achieved. I mean, really, KBOO is one of the models for not only being around 50 years, but doing it so well. And Pacifica has just a legendary series of mismanagement problems. It's a miracle. It's on the air. There's really no national daily program anymore for news. There used to be. On the other hand, Democracy Now! With Juan Gonzalez and Amy Goodman, really a spin-off. It's overlapping with Pacifica, but that's a creation of creative people.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go right back to our callers. We got Jay. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. It's nice to hear you, Norman.
Thank you.
I was wondering if any of your work with the Democratic Party dealt with how to address the Supreme Court and its complete obstruction to any kind of democratic impulse. That's very clear. What's to be done? What would you like to see done? And what has been discussed realistically as a way to try to democratize the Supreme Court?
Well, short and medium term, realistically, it's to stop having Republican presidents. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, you know, and one of them was an author who just came through Portland in California, will stand in front of an audience of hundreds of people, you know, great progressive author, and say there's zero difference between Democrats and Republicans. That is preposterous. When you look at who's on the Supreme Court, if we're going to look at, say, Sotomayor or Ginsburg, and then we're going to look at Gorsuch and we're going to look at Kavanaugh, these are very different people on the Supreme Court with very different agendas. And so the sort of mechanistic way to do it is to stop having Republican presidents who make these appointments. Now, deeper than that, you know, we've got undemocratic structures built into the Constitution of the United States of America, supremely the Senate. And when people in Montana have the same number of senators as people in California or even Oregon, for that matter, there's something amiss. We have so many overhauls to do in terms of democratic structures.
Yeah, kind of the Senate almost kind of harks back to the House of Lords.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And the original reason why it was set up was, okay, to get these smaller states to sign on to this new government called the United States. And then, you know, for the first, 50, 60 years, there was not even any direct election. This is all to insulate people, is what Michael Perini calls democracy for the few, to insulate government from people. And this is an ongoing struggle.
503-231-8187, a unique chance to interact here with Norman Solomon, all around rabble rouser, both inside and outside the institutions. Let's go to Mitch. You're on the air.
Thank you, Norman, for stepping into the mosh pit. We get so little from the people that have been involved with the Democratic Party to come down and actually talk to wage slave workers. And my question to you is, why is it that, especially here in Oregon, we're in such a bind? The Republicans, not since the days of Hatfield, have presented anybody willing to give primacy to the public interest over the private interest. So we don't have an alternative, and yet our Democrats are privatizers, just like Obama was, and so there isn't an alternative to the privatization in policymaking, and no one is even making a demand to NPR, the public airwaves, for a wage slave week, like a program, a regularly scheduled program they've never had. I don't see a demand for that when the arguments against Planet Money, the arguments against Marketplace, the arguments against every week being this week on Wall Street, you can't lose that argument, but no one's making the demand. Where are the professional classes who, you rightly point out, should be appalled by the social side of Republicans, but where is the pressure on the Democrats to stop being the crony continuity with privatization policies?
Yeah, thanks, Mitch. Well, that's what insurgency is all about. I think that explains the rage that so many in the Clinton wing of the party have had towards the Bernie Sanders forces. And we have this relationship between the elite classes of the Democratic Party. I mean, let's face it, you know, the Republican Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wall Street, and the Democratic Party is like on a long-term lease arrangement. And these are insidious realities, and they intersect, as you mentioned, with the media climate and environment that we're in. How many daily newspapers in this country have a labor section? Last time I checked, it was zero. How many daily newspapers in this country have a business section? Last time I checked, it was every single one. And then you mentioned so-called public broadcasting, and you've got really insidious corporate outlet or programs such as Planet Money and Features and so forth. Well, there's a Marketplace program, which isn't technically NPR, but I think it's PRI, public broadcasting. And Marketplace, you know, ironically, it's not as corporate as All Things Considered in Morning Edition and the PBS NewsHour on television. So these are outlets that supplant or dominate. While, when was the last Labor Place program you heard on public radio? It doesn't exist.
Well, you know, that brings up again, the thing I mentioned at the beginning, that we both wrote for the Alliance newspaper at one time. Maybe we overlapped a little bit there because I started in 86, I think. Anyway, you know, it's always astounding to me sometimes to think that, you know, I always kind of waver between thinking, you know, we're so, you know, marginalized in terms of like media, either KBOO or the Alliance, and then realizing that sometimes you actually have this outsized impact just because someone is actually like telling the truth, is actually like revealing. Like I remember, you know, I covered the salmon scam, David So Happy case, and nobody was covering it. Or like the, you know, the Alliance was covering, you know, the forest issues way before the Oregonian, and, you know, similarly KBOO. And just by virtue of the fact that we were covering those things, it actually, in some strange way, I think because at the time, you know, it was before the internet, I think there's a fair number of reporters for the, you know, the Oregonian or the big, we're actually kind of mining alternative media for story ideas, partly. Plus, you know, just, I don't know, there's, the universe sometimes works in mysterious ways. That, you know, finally, and I'm not saying it was due exclusively to my coverage, but I think it had an impact. I think you could probably relate similar stories. Mm-hmm. You know, the Oregonian picked it up and it became a bigger issue. And similarly, you know, with the forest, I didn't start writing about it, but the Alliance, you know, it's like, unless someone is actually telling those stories, it's like, you know, if a tree falls in the forest, no one notices anyway.
I think there's an important point there, because a lot of this coverage and these social and political sensibilities, if you will, percolate from alternative independent media outlets. I have no doubt that what the Alliance newspaper has covered, what KBOO has done, has very often percolated into outlets. Well, first, you know, Willamette Week, and then the Oregonian or whatever, the local and regional so-called public broadcasting. And I talked to a reporter at the New York Times, a very famous one, who said that they really scour the internet. They have a sense of impact from independent progressive outlets. And unfortunately, too, the right-wing online outlets have had huge effects on, they've normalized really racist, outrageous outlooks and story angles that have been picked up by places like CNN or the Washington Post or New York Times. But on the positive end, what progressives are doing in independent media, valuable in its own right, but also has significant impact ultimately on mainline news. And let's keep in mind, you know, it was the feminist movement of the late 60s into the 70s and beyond that just created things we now take for granted, like the New York Times no longer has a woman's page. You know, no longer separates the want ads into men jobs and women jobs. Well, we would now think it would be preposterous to do that, but 50, 60 years ago, it was routine.
Well, we have two. I was going to make a further kind of a pathetic lament that the Alliance newspaper is no longer around. And, you know, I think the Mercury and a little bit the Willamette Week have picked up this slack to some extent, but there's really no substitute for just a fully self-proclaimed, you know, radical alternative, which the Alliance certainly was, and printed way more in-depth kind of stuff than you tend to get from the Mercury.
For good or ill, yeah. A lot of this has moved online.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the barriers to entry tend to be lower, although still, you know, appreciable.
All right. We have two people named John and a Carolyn online. Let's go to our first John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
That might be me.
Go ahead. Sounds like it's you.
Yes. Okay. Well, Mr. Solomon, I would be very curious for you to expand on the subject, in the history of the subject of taxing the rich.
Well, you know, it's somewhat legendary and also true that during the Eisenhower presidency, the marginal tax rate federally was 91%. And I'm not sure exactly what it is now, but it's just, you know, a fraction of that. And it used to be understood that a progressive income tax structure was just called, among other things, decency and the way we have a society. And now, I mean, just in the last year, I just saw a stat where, thanks to the Trump administration and what it's been able to get through Congress, the corporate taxes have dropped by 30%. Well, who's picking up that burden? It's either the rest of us, and or it's, in not financial terms, the further decimation of the public sector, basic services, environmentally, healthcare, housing, infant mortality rates suffering, taking care of the elderly. So for many different reasons, the falling away of the basic concept of taxing the wealthy with sharply progressive income tax structures, as with the falling away, for instance, of the concept of antitrust action, and all of these ways the neoliberalization, the right-wingization of economic policy, this is where you walk around Portland or any city in this country, and really, if you have your eyes open and you don't just go to the rich areas where people with money are sitting in cafes drinking, you see a society being ravaged. And that's where I believe that an agenda for Medicare for all, an agenda of democratic socialism, is really our only hope.
Well, let's, before we go to our next caller, in your corporate power in the party section, which you talked about earlier, you mentioned there's 33 Democrats joined most Republicans to pass the measure to weaken the Dodd-Frank Act. And, you know, you could probably similarly talk about some of these measures, you know, to pass corporate taxes. So you say these 33, nearly all of the 33 identify as corporate, quote, new Democrats. So how much is there just power in sort of this hardcore nucleus of a sort of retrograde Democrat people? And, you know, is part of the insurgency to just overthrow, you know, to unelect, to get people to run opposing those 33? What, talk about
absolutely
that.
I believe that primary challenges are key. Of course, we know about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez defeating the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House, Joe Crowley, for Congress. And Ocasio-Cortez is headed to Congress from the Queens Bronx district. And there are several other people. Rashida Tlaib is already calling for the impeachment of Trump. She's a Democratic socialist who has won essentially John Conyers' old seat in Detroit. There are several very progressive folks, and they are really being clear, not only with primary challenges, but in the halls of Congress, to fight against the corporatists and the warmongers. And in terms of corporatists, that includes quite a few Democrats. So that's a challenge up ahead. And I think that when we're willing and able to effectively challenge corporate Democrats in primaries, then that opens up the possibility of moving the party farther to the left in terms of governance.
All right, well, let's go to our next caller. We've got another John online. Go ahead, you are on the air. Well, we don't have John anymore. He gave up. Let's go to Carolyn. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep. Yes.
Oh, beautiful. Okay, I had a question about, like, government trying to shift their duties onto private corporations. For example, like Trump has suggested, you know, making the USPS privatized, or privatizing our highways, privatizing our water infrastructure, just to relieve them basically of the burden that they're elected to do while they profit personally. That's horrible, and how could we stop that? That's my first question. And then second question, if Republicans do win this election and they have like a 60 majority and they can start repealing constitutional amendments like the two-term presidential limit, for example, and things went from bad to very, very, very worse, like we had not Germany here in the United States, but with Trump having repealed or backed out of the nuclear agreement, I mean, if things were really bad here in this country, what other country around the world would dare to come and defend us? So what are your answers on that? And because of that, like, who in our military would be responsible for saying enough, we're going against this, if we're doing a military coup to take back our democracy? I mean, what are the possibilities of that ever happening? And who would be responsible to make that decision in a worst-case scenario?
Thank you for that. Okay. And taking the most recent first, I mean, I never thought of it really in terms of other countries coming and defend us. I'm sort of looking at how we're going to defend ourselves from ourselves, or not ourselves, but our suppression. The attacks on democracy are overwhelmingly homegrown, the Koch brothers, big money in general, the corporate system. That's the huge threat to democracy. It's so ironic people want to talk about Putin. Nobody wakes up really in the morning in this country except for some of the punditocracy and says, you know, I'm really worried about Putin. People wake up and they think about healthcare, education, housing. People in Georgia are looking at least 53,000 people, it looks like, disenfranchised for the basic right to vote. I say, somewhat cryptically, that it's really unfair and disrespectful of America to say that Russia is responsible for undermining our democracy, because American ingenuity has done that quite well. And we have to deal with the reality quite seriously that our problems with absence of and suppression of democracy are overwhelmingly homegrown. So taking your other questions in sort of reverse order, the Republican power is so extreme, and the Republican Party is so extreme in terms of the racism and hostility to the most fundamental fragmentary democratic rights, that I think it's imperative, you know, progressives have a responsibility to fight the neo-fascists and to fight these xenophobes and racists. And that means, unless, again, we're going to get into hallucinations that don't belong in politics, there's no way you're going to take the House of Representatives away from the Republicans unless you do it with Democrats. That's just is the real world. And finally, for instance, the post office. This is one of the huge crimes that has been ongoing for the last 10 years, and that is to privatize the post office. And one big step was taken that way by the people who President Obama appointed to the board of the U.S. Postal Service. And this is really an assault, and it's an assault on the New Deal. It's an assault on the very basis of the public sector. We need to defend the post office. The privatization forces are circling around for the kill.
Okay. Thank you for calling, Carolyn. And thank all of you for calling in. We maybe have time to squeeze one last caller, but you have to make it quick. 503-231-8187. I've been talking with Norman Solon. Coming up next, the radioactivist talks to author Joshua Hunt about his book, University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education. Air Cascadia follows at 10:15. As always, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And 11, the Recovery Zone welcomes environmental journalist Ben Goldfarb and Beaver Ambassador Stephen Mershall to discuss the role beavers can play in environmental restoration. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you have not yet become one, you can become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Norman Solomon, so you're going to be speaking tonight at Willamette University, as you mentioned, 7:30. That's in Salem. I'm sure people can find out where that is easily enough. And at the University of Oregon tomorrow night.
That's right, at the Wayne Morse Center. And that one in Eugene is at 6:30.
And it's been so wonderful to have you here. We talked bit about your time in Portland. I guess I don't know how much time you've spent in Portland in the last few years, but it has changed a lot since 1970.
It has. You know, I think it was called the biggest small town in America back then. And, you know, the bus system was terrible. So it's gotten so much better that way. The city hall was run by basically a bunch of corporatists who were hostile to people of color. I don't know how much that has changed, but I know it's not as bad as it used to be, and there have been some real progressives. So it's exciting to me out of the corner of my eye to see a lot of the progress that's been made, again, because of activism. And, of course, the Trojan nuclear power plant has been shut down at last, these many last years. So, you know, it's a testament to people organizing, the positive things that have been happening.
Of course, Hanford still hangs over us.
Yes, the nuclear military-industrial complex, and that is something where, you know, it gives me a chance to mention the two existential crises, as Noam Chomsky has said, for humanity on this earth are climate change and nuclear weapons. And a lot of folks have woken up to the climate issues that are so profound. And there's been a real failure in the news media, part of this, Democratic Party and Republicans, of course, part of this, not dealing with the existential threat from nuclear weapons and the nuclear weapons industry. And an irony, I would say, is that nuclear winter would be climate change in a matter of weeks and end all agriculture on this planet if there was a thermonuclear war. And yet somehow, and this is news media bifurcating and separating, isolating into silos, but let's not separate climate from nuclear weapons. It is a one and the same issue, really.
And we could get way deeper into that, but let's give Robert a chance to give a 20-second question, because we got to get off the air here real soon. Go ahead, Robert.
Okay, thank you very much for taking my call. Mr. Solomon, I'm a physician, and I was wondering if you were aware that this neoliberal form of capitalism that we currently have is really bad for our health. We're a lot sicker, and we die young compared to our wealthy countries like Canada and the Scandinavian countries.
Okay, we've got to cut it off right there, but thank you. Go ahead, Norman.
Absolutely. I totally agree. When you get to the realm of public health, tremendous amounts of money being spent on health care in this country, so much of it siphoned off to the insurance and hospital and pharmaceutical industries. And the solution really is single payer. Medicare for all is really the way to go. And, you know, this is part of a broader assault on our environment, so many different ways, even working crummy jobs that are oppressive, whether it's Amazon or whatever. This is part of the fabric of assault on human beings to the detriment of public health. And we really need to turn this around. And again, I think that means a whole different system that we need to fight for step by step.
Well, you know, we're just about out of time, and we never got to the topic that I really wanted to talk about, reform or revolution. Which is it?
Well, I think it's inherent that it's both at the same time, and all great changes, whether we like it or not, that last are incremental, and we need to have our feet on the ground and our eyes on the horizon, because the changes we need are profound and huge. And if we want to call them revolution, great.
Well, my thing, though, and I know we can't talk about this in the next 30 seconds, but, you know, the urgency of the rapidity of climate change, it seems to be having these feedback loops that are kicking in into some strange. It doesn't it change the way we look at things?
Well, the urgency is there. I think, among many others, Bernie Sanders has been saying that. Antonio Gramsci put it this way: pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, and we need a lot of both.
On that, I think that's a great last note to end on. Thank you so much. And thanks to Heather, our board operator, all of you called, and certainly all of you listen. Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.
Talk about destruction. Don't you know what you can count me? In, out, in, out. Be all right. Be all right. Be all right. See, you got a resolution. Well, you know. Well, I'd love to see the flag. You ask for a contribution. Well, you know. Well, I'm doing what we can. One money people mind that hate. I'll tell you, brother, have to wait. All right, all right, all right. Want to change the Constitution? Well, you know, they don't want to change your head. And act as an institution? Well, you know, better free your mind instead. Go kind, pick your chairman out.